What must I do? You will know. How long had we been on the road? I could not count the number of weeks, months. It seemed a long time, a very long time, since that dreadful day when Jocelyn and I had failed to outrace death to Delaunay's door. And yet now it would come to an end, and it seemed too fast. We made our camp in the foothills, a prudent distance from the battle. Come morning, we would attack. I went with Guilin and the others to survey the siege. With the sun settling low over the plain, we could see the embattled fortress, still flying the Courcelle Swan, an island in a sea of scaldy forces. Beyond the breached bulwarks, the half-burned skeleton of a siege tower leaned against one wall, and there, on the plain, was the charred wreckage of the tower Drustin's Cruinia had ignited. But there were two towers yet, moved nearly into position, and the Scaldi were making ready a great battering ram to try the gates. Only the archers and the trebuchet in the fortress were keeping them at bay. If the Scaldi got one of their towers in place and swarmed the parapet, it would soon be done. They were withdrawing out of range now, with the setting sun, to renew efforts with the dawn.
"We'll wait for daybreak," Guilin murmured, "and pray they know us for allies in the fortress. The sooner they counterattack the Scaldi rear, the better our chances." "You think they'll flock to aid the Deglamore Eagle?"
Isidore Deglamore asked wryly.
"Don't count on their being quick, cousin."
"My father is no fool," Guilin stared through the gloaming at the distant fortress.
"Drustin's men are flying the Culloch Gorum. He'll know. If he can even see the Black Pig, over 30,000 howling Scaldi," Deglamore threw back from the vantage and shrugged matter-of-factly. "We'll do as much damage as we can, and pray it's enough to break the siege. But for every minute your father hesitates, and for every minute it takes for them to marshal a counterattack, we'll die by the hundreds."
One of Fedra's boys, Eugène, whom Quintilius Rous had prized for his long vision, gazed out over the battlefield and made a choked sound, pointing. It was hard to make out events at such a distance, the figures tiny, but not so hard that we couldn't see a line of prisoners being led among the camps of the Scaldi, shoved and stumbling. Their gowns made bright spots of colour against the dust and steely turmoil of a war camp. Women, all of them. Dangeline women. Selig's army had cut a swath through northern Namar before Percy de Somerville's force had intercepted them. We'd not seen it before. They had taken slaves. We watched it silently, too far away to hear if they cried out. I doubt it. They would have been some weeks among the Scaldi. One grows numb to almost anything after a while. Still, I could not look away until Jocelyn took my shoulders and pulled me gently back. I pressed my face to his chest and shuddered. When I lifted my head, Isidore Deglamore was watching us both, his expression somber.
"I am sorry," he said quietly, "for what was done to you both. For what it's worth, I am sorry."
Jocelyn, holding me, nodded.
"Daybreak," Guilin de Somerville said grimly.
Chapter 86. I awoke a little past moonrise. It was the rustling tide in my blood that awoke me. Kushiel's presence around me like great bronze wings, setting my blood to beating in my ears. Lifting my head from my bedroll, I gazed across our sleeping camp and saw everything washed in a red haze of blood, staining armor, faces, horses, drowsing with heads low and a rear leg cocked. For every minute that passed, they would die by the hundreds. Kushiel's voice whispered in my ear,
"Now."
I covered my face with my hands and knew. It was not such a difficult thing to arise without waking anyone near me. Our sentries were posted outward. They'd no orders to restrain movement within the camp, and I know how to be quiet. It is the first thing they teach in the night court. Before anything else, we learn it. To be unobtrusive, invisible, to attend unseen and unnoticed. Delaunay taught us too. Leaving Jocelyn was the hardest, because I knew he'd never forgive me for it. I stooped over him as he slept, lying silvered in the moonlight, like Endymion in the old Hellene tale. I pressed my lips to his brow, light enough that he only murmured in his sleep. "Goodbye, my Carsiel," I whispered, smoothing his hair. Then I rose and pinned about me my traveling cloak, a deep brown velvet, Quinsel de Morban's gift. It was dark enough to serve. I picked my way through our darkened camp. No fires had been allowed, lest the Scaldi spot them, and sought out Isidore d'Eglamour. He came awake in an instant when I knelt by his side, inborn Carmeline reflexes sending him reaching for his sword. Its point was at my throat before I could speak. "You," he said, eyes narrowing in the moonlight, "what is it?" "My lord," I spoke in a low voice that would not carry, "the fortress will be ready for your attack." Sheathing his sword, d'Eglamour stared at me.
"You'll be captured."
"Not before I gain the wall." I wrapped my arms around myself and shivered. "The Scaldi camp is full of d'Angeline women. I can get close enough, and I can give a warning Isandra will understand." d'Eglamour shook his head slowly.
"Do you not understand? Selig will make you talk. You'll give us all up for dead."
"No," a dreadful laugh caught in my throat. "No, my lord, I am the one person who will not." It was too dark for him to make out the scarlet mote in my left eye, but I saw him look anyway and remember. Isidore d'Eglamour pushed his shining hair back from his face.
"Why are you telling me?"
he asked in a hard voice. "Because you, my lord, are the one person who won't try to stop me," I said softly. "Help me get past our sentries. 100 lives for every minute, you said. I can save 1,000 at least. Mayhap 3 times that many. I gave you the choice of your death. The least you can do is honor mine." I thought he might refuse, but in the end he gave a curt nod. I had chosen well in Isidore d'Eglamour. We walked together to the outskirts of our encampment, where one of his men was posted. D'Eglamour called him aside for a word, and the soldier obeyed with alacrity. It is no discredit to him that he did not see as I slipped past in the shadows. He was not looking to be deceived. So I left the camp. When all was said and done, I had made harder journeys. It could not even compare to Jocelyn and Mai's flight through the frigid depths of a Scaldic winter, and it was fraught with none of the unnatural terrors of crossing the straits. But there are ways and ways for a thing to be difficult, and in some of them this was the hardest journey of all. Once I left d'Eglamour behind, I was alone. It took a great deal of care climbing soundlessly down the foothills. I'd have taken a horse if I dared, but Guilin's Lagnesite archers were posted with orders to shoot at anything that stirred on the approaches. I would not test their skill, even shooting blind. They can shoot a crow in a cornfield by the rustle of the grasses, and a horse makes a good deal of noise and a sizable target by moonlight. I made a small target and very little noise. It took me an hour and better to make my descent, moving quickly after I cleared the outermost perimeter of our guards. I clambered downward using hands and feet alike, and my hands were torn by the rocks, but I gained the plain.
2 hours I gauged, to cross it and make my way to the fortress walls. It was little more than a mile to reach the outer skirts of the sprawling Scaldi army, but making my way through the encampment would be a slow process. It was enough. I had at least 4 hours until dawn. The plain lay still and silent beneath the high, bright moon, and I crossed it in an agony of terror, starting at every sound. It is a wonder to me that the small creatures of the field, mice, rabbits, a night-hunting snake, do not flee the advent of war for miles all around. Once an owl's cry made me jump, tangling one foot in the hem of my gown, sending me sprawling to earth. With both hands planted in the rich soil of Terre d'Ange, I tried to slow the terrified beating of my heart. I found a smooth rock beneath one hand and carried it with me. I went onward. A child's ploy to distract the Scaldi sentry dozing on his spear, nothing more. I threw the rock, hurling it with all my might. It fell to earth with a dull thud, and he looked that way. I passed the other way, drawing my hood about my face. "Never despise a trick because it is simple," Delaunay said. "The old ploys endure because they work." That would be the most dangerous part, I thought. Until I reached the Scaldi camp. The fortified earthworks that surrounded Trois-le-Mont had been breached in a dozen places, undermined by sappers burst with rams. It would have gone even quicker had Selig had catapults, but mercifully it seemed that was one element of Tiberian technology that had proved too difficult for his Scaldi engineers to replicate with any accuracy. Bad enough they had learned to build siege towers. Mindful of the Alban attack some days before, Selig had posted sentries at the largest breaches, but they were looking for an army, not a lone intruder. Circling the bulwarks at a distance, I spotted a gap scarce large enough to admit a child. Where the sappers had broken through and abandoned the place where their cohorts had succeeded elsewhere. The earth and timber walls cast a deep shadow. Crouching in it, I worked feverishly with both hands, widening the hole until it was large enough to get my head and shoulders into it. Halfway through, I got stuck. It was a tight fit, and something, I don't know what, the clasp of my girdle, mayhap, caught on the rough timbers that formed the framework of the bulwark. I wriggled frantically, struggling not to panic, striving to remain silent. I was stuck fast. "Kushiel," I thought, "you did not send me to die here." I gave one last convulsive push, and something gave way, allowing me to spill out on the far side of the wall. Collecting myself, I knelt in the darkness and glanced around. I was behind enemy lines once more. Far ahead of me stood the embattled fortress, looming against the night sky. The outer windows were darkened, but I could see lights moving deep within and torches on the battlements, where patrols went to and fro, keeping a watch on the quiet Scaldi camp. Between us lay the Scaldi. Taking a deep breath, I left the wall and began to make my way through the encampment. The outermost ranks were the easiest. Trusting to Selig and the sentries, they slept deeply, rolled in their cloaks, letting the embers of their watchfires burn low. The Scaldi had no fear of being seen, or the world knew where they were. Picking my torturous way among them, I could see where the divisions lay, tribal and deeply ingrained. I had seen it at the Althing. I knew. Here and there among the slumbering camps lay lines of division. Marni and Marcy, Dombrivi, Suevi and Vandali. I picked my way among them, following the invisible fault lines, avoiding an outstretched hand here, an iron-thewed leg there. It is not to say that there were none awake and watching, and none who saw me. Some Scaldi were, and did, much as I sought to avoid it. But they saw, what, a lone d'Angeline woman, young and dishevelled, shivering with fear. I kept my head bowed and angled toward the direction from which they'd brought the prisoners, praying it would suffice. Ellawa was merciful. It did. So many, Scaldi. It was unreal to me, the numbers of them, and they looked so harmless, sleeping. Fierce moustaches and braided beards like ornaments on their sleep-softened faces, shields and weapons set aside like children's toys. Would that they were no more than they seemed in slumber. It grew more difficult the closer I got to Trois-le-Mont. I held my line toward the prisoners' camp as long as I dared, but at last I must cut inward, heading for the fortress, toward where the burned skeleton of a siege tower reared up above the moon-glimmering water of the moat. Selig had patrols posted here, roaming along the perimeter, keeping an eye on the defenders. All my wiles I used to avoid their detection. Even so, it scarce sufficed. I ducked back hard to evade an approaching patrol, huddling in the shadow of a firm-planted shield. The corner of my cloak caught the edge of a stack of spears, sending them clattering to earth. The nearest Scaldi, his arm thrown carelessly over a young d'Angeline woman, stirred and lifted his head. He blinked at me, bleary-eyed, then smiled slowly.
"Where do you run to, little dove?" he asked in Scaldi, raising himself on one arm. "Come, I'll show you your new home."
One looks for aid where one can in times of fear. My terrified gaze slid to the woman beside him. Her eyes were wide and clear. She had been awake. We stared at each other in the moonlight, d'Angeline's alike, and I realized that she wore the rent and dirt-stained robes of a priestess of Namar. Of course, we were in Namar, Namar's country. But I had not thought the Scaldi would raid her temples. "Where are you going, Messiah?" she asked in d'Angeline, catching his arm and drawing him back to her. "Would you leave me to the cold?" If he did not understand her words, he understood her intent, laughing and nuzzling her neck. Crouched in the shadows, I held her gaze as it watched me over the warrior's shoulder, bleak and resolute. I mouthed the words silently, "Thank you," and fled into the darkness, offering a blessing to Namar, who had protected her servant. So I gained the ruined siege tower. How often had I cursed Anarfiel de Launay for forcing me to endure the endless drill of our tumbling master? I have repented of it since. I repented of it now, grasping the scorched timbers and hauling myself upward. Up, up into the night I climbed, facing the grey stone walls of Trois-le-Mont, from which I was separated only by the width of the narrow moat. The tower had gotten close. If they'd bridged the moat, it was high enough to clear the battlements. But they hadn't, and the distance of their failure was the distance of my fate. I climbed as high as I dared, charcoal from the burnt framework smudging my torn hands and rent clothing. Still, a kind of exhilaration overcame me, as it had on the rafters of Selig's great hall. On the sloping underside of the nearest tower was the Mouetriere, an opening from which the defenders could shoot at the attackers below. Surely, I thought, it must be manned in such times. I broke off bits of burnt timber from the framework of the siege tower, tossing them at the narrow window. Lights moved within, torches bobbing. I saw the blur of a d'Angeline face, removed quickly and replaced with the point of a crossbow's quarrel, aimed in my direction. My blood beat in my ears. "Hold!" I cried aloud, letting my voice ring clear in the night. "In the name of Isandre de la Courcelle, hold!" The archer held, and shouts arose from the Scaldi patrol. Figures raced in the darkness below me, swarming the base of the tower. The crossbow withdrew, replaced by the same face, perplexed eyes meeting my own.
I clung to the framework, leaning out as far as I dared, letting the faint torchlight from the battlements above illuminate my face. "Tell the Queen," I shouted, "that Delaunay's other pupil has done her bidding." That much and no more I got out, before hands grasped me from below, dragging at me. My fingers lost their grip, splinters wedged beneath my nails. Then I was loose and falling, my head striking hard against a timber before I was caught ungently by Scaldy arms. They forced me down the burnt tower, pushing me harshly, but not letting me fall when my trembling arms gave way or my feet slipped from the supports. I could hear the uproar arising in the camp, watchfires fanned to a blaze as I was brought to earth. One of the Scaldies shoved me, as my feet touched ground, and I stumbled, falling to my knees before the captain of the watch on patrol. He cuffed me once, then glowered.
"What were you doing, eh?" he asked in Scaldic, cursing me. "Did you think to gain the castle? Your place lies that way, slave." He pointed toward the prison camp. "Do you know the punishment for flight?"
"She can't understand you, Eggle," one of my captors laughed, twisting a hand in my hair. I would have laughed, too, if I hadn't feared hysteria. They thought I was a runaway slave. Steel and flame and scaldy faces streaked across my vision, and the rank smell of a battlefield filled my senses. Somewhere a rider approached.
"Oh, I think she understands."
It was a different voice, deep and commanding, and rich with irony. I knew it. I knew it well, better than I cared to remember. My scaldy captor wrenched at my hair, tilting my head back, forcing me to meet the speaker's eyes. He was tall, taller even than I recalled, the breadth of his shoulders looming against the fortress behind him. His hazel eyes, meeting mine, narrowed, and his lips curved in a smile.
"Don't you, Phaedra?" Voldemar Selig asked softly.
Chapter 87. "Yes, my Lord Selig," I forced the words out. Dismounting and handing his reins to a waiting thane, Voldemar Selig stepped forward and struck me twice across the face. My head reeled.
"That," he said calmly, "I owe to you."
Grabbing my forelock in his fist, he yanked my head up and stared at me.
"What were you doing on the tower?"
I stared back at him and kept silent. Twice more he struck me, hard and fast.
"What were you doing?"
Touching my tongue to my lower lip, I tasted blood.
"She shouted somewhat," one of my captors said helpfully.
"What was it?"
Selig asked, not relinquishing his grip. They argued over it, puzzling out the words in phonetic Dangeline. Swaying on my knees, I watched Selig's lips move silently as he tried to put the words together. He spoke passable Dangeline. I knew I'd helped teach him.
Tell the Queen that Delaunay's other something has done her..."
The words were too badly mangled for his ear. Frustration seized him, and he shook my head like a rattle.
"Send for one of the prisoners," he ordered.
It was the priestess of Nama. She was closest. Summoning a measure of dignity, she wrapped her stained red robes around her as they herded her across the plain. Her gaze slid across my face as if without recognition, as she stood listening to the garbled phrase the patrol captain repeated.
"Tell the Queen that Delaunay's other pupil has done her bidding," she said coolly in Dangeline.
I do not think she reckoned on Selig's comprehension. It unnerved her a little when he smiled. I watched his smile fade, though, and knew bitter triumph. The words meant nothing to him.
"Thank you,"
he said to Nama's priestess in curt Dangeline, adding in Scaldic,
"Take her back among the prisoners."
She glanced back once over her shoulder, then I saw her no more. Selig considered me, still holding my head up-tilted.
"It will go better for you if you tell me," he said almost gently. "I don't owe you a quick death, but I'm willing to give it you, if you'll speak."
He was handsome for a Skaldi. I've said as much. The torchlight borne by warriors pressing round glinted from the gold fillet that bound his hair, the gold wire that twisted his beard into twin forks. My face ached, and tears stood in my eyes. I did laugh then. I'd nothing left to lose. "No, my lord," I said simply, "I will take the other choice." Cursing, he released his grip on my hair, thrusting me away. He turned to look thoughtfully at the fortress.
"You claim to find pleasure in pain," he said. "Then let Isandra de la Courcelle see how well Voldemar Selig pleases her spies."
I have said, too, that Selig was a clever man. He knew well the merits of controlling the minds of one's enemies. He had a vast space cleared in front of the fortress, just beyond the range of the archers, and had it ringed round with torchbearers. The barbican over the gate of Trois Le Mans was full lit by then, and no doubt the defenders were watching. I knew it. Selig knew it, too. Two of his thanes walked me out into the middle of the space, forcing me to my knees. White brethren, their pelts tied loosely around their necks in the warmth of summer, woolens exchanged for steel and leather. Selig wore white wolf hide, too, snowy by moonlight, trimming the tunic beneath his armor. He stepped into the circle of torchlight and wrenched at the neck of my gown, tearing it open. I felt the night air moving upon the bare skin of my back.
"Isandra de la Courcelle," he shouted, his voice carrying. "See what becomes of spies and traitors."
I heard the sound of his belt dagger rasping clear of its sheath, felt the point of it placed against the skin of my left shoulder blade. The white brethren held my arms as he began to cut. Voldemar Selig was known to be a mighty hunter. Unlike Dangeline nobles, Skaldic lords do not have servants to perform distasteful chores. They skin and gut their own kills. When Selig scored a strip of flesh from my back and began slowly to pull it down, I knew what he intended. He was going to skin me alive.
I have known pain. Elowen knows I have known it. But nothing had ever prepared me for this.
I gasped aloud as he cut, and when he took the strip of flesh, slippery with blood, in a pincer-like grip, and began to draw it down, I screamed. And it would go on for a long time. Pain burst red across my vision, staggering me. I knew where I was, and did not. "Kushiel," I thought, and my blood roared in my ears, beating like wings. I have done all I could. It was a relief to surrender at last. At long last. I could hear my voice still, whimpering, ragged with pain, and Selig's whisper in my ear, "Tell me, tell me." These things happened, I know. And yet it all seemed distant and far beyond me, minor tempests on the outskirts of the maelstrom of agony I inhabited. The world lurched sideways through a blood-red haze, and hands dragged me upright. Pain blossomed all through me, finding a home at the base of my spine, radiating outward. Pain obliterates everything else. In pain there is only the eternal present. I fell into it, as if into a dark, bottomless well, seeing the bronze mask of Kushiel hanging before me, stern and compassionate, bronze lips moving, speaking words I felt in my bones. Pain redeems all. It is the awareness of life, a reminder of death. I saw faces, other faces, mortal and beloved. Delaunay, Alcuin, Cecily, Telesis, Hyacinth, Jocelyn, and more flickering too fast to number. Isandra, Quintilius Rouse, Drustin, the twins, Fedra's boys, Master Tialar, Guy. Some I didn't expect. Hatevik, Knut, Childric de Somme, the old Dawain, Loda One-Eye. Even at the end, my mother and father, dimly remembered, and the Skaldi mercenary, who had tossed me in the air and laughed through his moustaches.
Melisande.
Ah, Eloa, I did love her once.
It was the cessation of pain that brought me back. Selig's knife had halted in the course of parting my skin from my flesh, paused in an incredulous moment. A voice was speaking, one I knew, clear words ringing on the night air in heavily accented Skaldic.
Voldemar Selig, I challenge you to the Holmgang.
They let me go then, and I fell over, my cheek cradled on the dusty, trampled field. I bled into the dirt and blinked unbelieving at the figure that had parted the Skaldy ranks. Stolen armor and a stolen horse for disguise, he had done it before, and cast lean arms, summer blue eyes behind the wild, desperate dare.
Eloa, no, I murmured against Dangeline's soil.
Voldemar Selig stood staring, then laughed, laughed and laughed.
It would have been too much to ask, he declared joyfully, spreading his arms. Ah, old Father Odin, you are generous. Yes, Jocelyn Verai, let us dance upon the hides, and then, he turned, roaring his words toward Twalamont, then let Terdange see how Voldemar Selig deals with her champions.
These are the things the Skaldi love, the stuff of legend. 20 spears pointed at Jocelyn as he dismounted, and his stolen mount was seized. They stripped away his stolen armor, too, while a ripple ran through camp as they searched for a suitable hide to stake out for the Holmgang. Hauled to my knees and held in place by the two white brethren, I saw it all. Selig's hazel eyes gleamed keen and bright as he tested the heft of his shield. No one would lend one to Jocelyn. He stood at ease in the castling manner, only the steel vambraces on his forearms to protect him. I knelt bleeding, rife with pain, and cursed him in my soul. Whether Selig defeated him or not, it didn't matter. He wasn't fool enough to throw victory away on a game of honor. He would break Jocelyn, or worse, use me to do it.
Jocelyn, Jocelyn, I thought, tears running unheeded down my face. You've done it. You've truly done it, and killed us all with your damnable vow.
They took their places at opposite ends of the hide. Jocelyn crossed his arms and bowed. Voldemar Selig thrust his sword into the air, and the Skaldi shouted. One voice, 30,000 throats. They began to pound their weapons upon their shields, a measured beat. Selig turned to the dark, watching fortress, and swept a mocking bow. I knelt, awash in pain. And the Holmgang began. I would like to tell it in poet's words, this deadly dance they enacted on a few square feet of hide before the whole of the Skaldi army and the silent defenders of Twalamont. I would that I could. But they were fast, so fast, and I had come back a long way from Kushiel's realm. I saw swords flickering in the torchlight, streaks of steel awash in ruddy light, the sound of clashing metal lost in the beating surge of spear-butts against Skaldic shields. I saw Jocelyn's hair, wheat-gold against the darkness, fan out in a tangle of Skaldi braids as he spun, evading Selig's biting blade. Fast, but not fast enough. I saw his sleeve darken with spreading blood as the edge of Selig's sword slashed his arm above the vambrace. The beating rhythm hesitated, waiting to see if blood would spatter the hide. Selig tossed aside his cracked shield and reached for another, knowing without looking that a loyal thane was at hand. Jocelyn loosed the buckles of his vambrace one-handed, sliding it up and tightening it in place over the wound, using his teeth. Laughing, Voldemar Selig attacked, and the beat resumed. And I saw Jocelyn deflect his blow with one sweeping gesture, ready for the attack, his other hand coming up to resume the two-handed grip on his sword-hilt, and his sword slid high across the darkness as Selig raised his shield to parry, the point scoring a line across Selig's jaw. It bled rivulets into his tawny brown beard with its gold-wrapped fork, bled red rivulets that dropped fat red drops of blood onto the hide. The Skaldi ceased their pounding. In silence, Jocelyn bowed and sheathed his sword.
Voldemar Selig wiped one palm along his jaw and shook it contemptuously, spattering blood.
"For that,"
he said softly, raising his sword to point it at Jocelyn's heart,
"I will let you live long enough to see what is left of her when I am done, and have given what remains to my men."
I knew the whiteness of perfect despair. Jocelyn lifted his gaze to Selig's and stood motionless, his blue eyes tranquil.
"In Carsiel's name,"
he said, in a voice calm beyond calm,
"I protect and serve."
And he moved, flowing like water. All the Carsiel forms have names, poets' names, lovely and serene, drawn from nature. Birds on the wing, mountain streams, trees bending in the wind. It is how they name what they do. Except for the one they call Terminus. There is a play, a famous play, its name was lost in white light of despair, in which a Carsiel brother performs the Terminus. I saw a player act it out once in the Cockerel. I knew it then, swaying on my knees, held upright by my scaldy guards. When Jocelyn, spinning in my direction, tossed his right-hand dagger in the air and caught it by the blade, I knew. When he brought his left-hand dagger to his throat and set its point, I knew. It is the last act the perfect companion may perform. I met his eyes, the dagger in his right hand balanced to throw at my heart, the dagger in his left poised to cut his throat. I had judged him wrong. Truly he had come to save us both, in the only way left to us. I had not known, until that moment, how very deeply I had feared my fate. "Do it," I whispered. Jocelyn looked over my shoulder and froze. And then moved like lightning, his right hand whipping forward to throw the dagger. It caught the white brethren guard on my left in the throat, and he fell backward with scarcely a gurgle, his hand leaving my arm. I swayed, unbalanced. Jocelyn was coming toward me at a dead run, scarce pausing to snatch the hilt out of the Scaldy's throat. My other guard released me, fumbling for his sword. Too late. The crossed daggers took him high, too, opening gaping wounds on either side of his neck. Heedless of the pain it caused, Jocelyn grabbed my arm unhesitatingly, hauling me to my feet and plunging toward the fortress. Half-dragged, staggering in his wake and in agony, I saw it. The portcullis was being raised. The Scaldy army roared behind us as the drawbridge crashed down across the moat. We raced desperately across the ruined earth, my lungs burning for air, each step an agony of blossoming pain. That was when the night skies lit on fire. From atop the battlements the trebuchet were loosed, and gouts of flame seared the night. Fur de Hellas, liquid pitch, ignited and burning. It soared in an arc over our heads, splattering into the front line of our Scaldy pursuers, sending them rolling and screaming to earth. I heard Selig's voice rising above it all. "Advance!" he roared. "Advance! And get ahead of it, you fools!" How many listened, I don't know. Enough, I dare say. But then the earth shook, and from the dark mouth of the gate a mounted sortie emerged. 4 Siovales cataphracts, riders and horses alike, covered head to hoof with armor, gleaming silver and gold by firelight. They pounded past us on either side, slamming into the wall of the approaching Scaldy. And on their heels, 20-odd light-armed riders, turbaned and helmed, uttering a fierce Arcadian ululation. One swooped by me like a mounted hawk, a deft hand plucking me up to sling me across the pommel of his saddle. Jouncing in pain, I dimly saw Jocelyn take the hand of another, swinging up behind him in the saddle. We wheeled and turned. The cataphracts split off and surged back toward the drawbridge, heavy hooves pounding. The other riders roiled in a semicircle against the Scaldy, fingers plucking at horsemen's bows. The trebuchet atop the fortress thudded dully, and more fur de Hellas lit the air, glittering bright above the furious mien of Voldemar Selig, who stared unbelieving as his prize escaped. Hoofbeats echoed as we fled across the drawbridge, the defenders of the gatehouse already working frantically at the winches. The last members of the sortie made it with desperate leaps, horses stumbling on the slanted planks. The drawbridge shuddered into place, and they cut the ropes raising the portcullis, dropping it with a resounding crash. We had gained the inner ward. Slung across the saddle, limp and bleeding, I scarce heeded the commotion as the gatehouse guards rallied against the Scaldi, who threw themselves in waves at the moat, driving them back coolly with a rain of crossbow fire. Safe within the stone walls of the fortress courtyard, the riders of the sortie dismounted, jesting with disbelief to find themselves still alive. My rescuer was among them, removing his conical steel helm and running a hand through his short-cropped, pale hair. "Who would have thought," Barquier Lanvert said ironically, "I'd risk my life for a member of Delaunay's household." I met his wry violet gaze as he helped me down from my awkward position, but then my feet touched the flagstones, and my strength gave way. I kept going, crumpling into a heap in the courtyard of Toilemont.
Chapter 88.
Let her be.
There was a crowd around me, that much I knew, and then Jocelyn was there, mercifully, making them stand back and give me space to breathe. I clung to his hand as he knelt beside me, desperately grateful for his presence. Then the cry,
"Make way for the Queen!"
No fool, Isandra. She had come with Nysandine Chirurgeon, who felt at me with cool hands, turning me on my stomach and examining Selig's damage, cleaning away the blood. "It is not so bad as it looks," she said, reassuring, sending her assistant scrambling for a needle and thread. "He was aiming for pain, and not death." I gritted my teeth as she set the flap of skin back in place, anchoring it with deft stitches. But I did not cry out. They had heard enough of that, I reckoned. I could hear Isandra murmur something to Jocelyn, and his quiet reply. When it was done, the chirurgeon applied a salve and bound it tight with clean bandages, and I rose to my feet, my blood-soaked gown hanging loose from my shoulders. By this time the courtyard stood full and waiting with the greater part of the Dangeline royal army, amassed behind its lords and commanders, who stood aligned with Isandra de la Courcelle, the Queen of Terre d'Ange, flanked by two Castelline brothers, all of them waiting on my words. It was a little overwhelming. Stiff with pain, I made my curtsy to Isandra. I think she might have stopped me if we had been alone. I saw her catch her breath. I managed, "Your Majesty," I said, forcing my voice to steadiness. "Vedreno Delaunay," she inclined her head, "have we read your message aright?" I took a deep breath and gazed at the sea of waiting faces. "An army of 7,000 stands ready to attack Selig's rearguard at daybreak," I said aloud, hearing a murmurous echo as my words were passed backward through the ranks. Percy de Somerville, looking gaunt and tired, kindled to life.
"Eloa," he exclaimed, 7,000 Albans."
"No, my lord," I shook my head. "Half the force is Alban. The other half is Isidore d'Eglamour's army." This time the murmur rose nearly to a roar, surging in waves through the courtyard. I wavered on my feet, and Jocelyn caught my arm, steadying me. Disheveled and unwashed, hair in a half-braided tangle, one sleeve dark and stiff with blood, he looked nothing like his Castelline brethren, and about 10 times as dangerous.
"D'Eglamour," Barquier Lanvert said in disgust. "Whose fool idea was that?"
"Mine, my lord," I said evenly, "implemented by my lord de Somerville's son."
"Guillain?"
The light in Percy de Somerville's eyes grew brighter.
"Guillain is with them?"
I nodded, fighting exhaustion. "Guillain and a few hundred of his men. He left Marc de Trevelyan in command in Azal with Admiral Rous. They planned the attack together. Guillain, I mean, and d'Eglamour, and Druston, and the twins." I saw his face go blank. "The lords of the Dalriada."
Then Raus is alive, and Mark too.
It was Gaspard Trevelyan, his salt and pepper hair gone greyer in the months since I'd seen him. I learned later that he had lingered too long aiding Isandre and de Sommerville in organizing the defense of Toilemont, and been cut off from returning to Arzal to fight with his kinsmen. "Yes, my lord," I said, "when we left them."
"Thanks to Eloa,"
he murmured, grey eyes resting kindly on me,
"for their safety and yours."
"Why would Isidore d'Aiglemont aid us?"
asked a quiet voice. I recognized Thibault, the Siobelese Comte de Toulard, more soldier than scholar now.
"Because,"
I shifted and winced. My back throbbed and burned like fire. D'Aiglemont had been right. They were loath to trust him. I hadn't reckoned on this difficulty. I'd not reckoned on being alive.
"He is d'Angeline, my lord, and he is dead no matter what happens. I gave him the choice of a hero's death."
Barquier Lanvert looked hard at me.
"Are you that sure of him, Delaunay's pupil, that you'd risk our lives on it?"
"Yes, my lord," I held his gaze. "Why did you come for me when you despised my lord Delaunay?"
"Because," Lanvert's eyes glinted, acknowledging my point, "because we are d'Angeline, Phèdre no Delaunay, and young Berai afforded Selig's men with a distraction."
He clapped his hand on Jocelyn's shoulder.
"Good thing we came before you played out your Castline endgame, yes?"
He laughed at Jocelyn's level stare.
"But d'Aiglemont is a traitor. Whatever Delaunay may have thought of me, I never let the Scaldy in the door. What does d'Aiglemont care who sits the throne if he's dead either way? We set him up with Baudouin's men. Do you think he wouldn't take the chance to serve us the same?"
Isandra watched us, giving nothing away. The lords and the army were waiting on her decision. "Oh, Isidore d'Aiglemont cares," I said softly, "and he wants revenge." I touched the diamond at my throat. "He is not playing for you, my lady," I said to Isandra. "He is playing against Melisande Charizai." There was a silence.
"That would do it," Lanvert admitted slowly.
"My lord de Sommerville," Isandra said crisply, turning to Percy, "we will support our allies and mount a counter-attack on the Scaldy army. Will you so command it?"
Percy de Sommerville bowed, his face firm with resolve. "Your Majesty, I will."
Willingness and relief in his voice. His son was leading those allies. There was a muffled sound from the gatehouse. One of the defenders ran panting into our midst, saluting de Sommerville.
"They're breaking up the siege tower to lay timbers across the moat, my lord," he said, wiping his forearm across his brow. "Selig's out there, madder than a pricked bull."
"Use everything we have."
I didn't know the lord who spoke, a Cuchulain by his accent. Excitement was beginning to spread in the wake of Isandre's pronouncement.
"Set an archer at every arrow slit, and rain down fire upon them. We've only to hold out till dawn."
Cheering rose, setting my ears to ringing.
"No!"
Percy de Sommerville's voice quelled it. He glared at the lord who'd spoken.
"Listen well,"
he said grimly into the subdued quiet that followed.
"The last thing we want to do is make Voldemar Selig think we can afford to waste our armaments in fending him off. The moment he thinks we're confident, he'll start to ask himself why. We need to dig in and let him think we've overextended ourselves. He's angry. Good. Keep him mad and hungry, and above all, keep his attention on the fortress. Let him get as close as you dare before you drive him back."
With a quick glance at Isandra for permission, he began issuing orders, sketching out a plan of defense, and calling for the muster of the whole of the army. I knew then that my role was done, truly done, and could have wept with relief to see the amassed forces in the courtyard surge into action, following de Sommerville's commands, sure and orderly. Isandra looked at me with compassion.
Come, she said, gesturing toward the inner gate. You shouldn't be standing, let alone walking and talking. I've a few attendants inside. Let us at least make you comfortable. Messiah Varai, will you assist?
A moment, Your Majesty, Jocelyn murmured, turning aside to catch Thibaut de Toulard's sleeve. My lord, can you tell me if my father is here? He is Chevalier Milan Varai of Siorval. My brother Luke would be with him, and 4 or 5 men-at-arms, perhaps.
De Toulard hesitated and shook his head regretfully.
I'm sorry, Messiah Varai. There are some 1,600 Siorvalis, and I do not know them all. You might ask the Duke de Perigueux, who commands for Siorval.
His Grace de Perigueux is on the battlements, a passing soldier commented, or was at last count. One of the trebuchets, not firing. South wall, I think.
No, it was the west, came a dissenting voice.
Other voices offered comments. The Siorvali's command, it seemed, was to be found wherever mechanical difficulties arose. They are clever with such things, Shemhazai's line, and no one knew of Jocelyn's father or brother.
Go find him, I said, seeing Isandra arch an impatient brow. I'm fine.
Jocelyn looked incredulously at me.
You're a long way from fine, he muttered, picking me up unceremoniously, careful of my injuries, though heedless of my dignity. Your Majesty, he said, nodding to Isandra.
Inside it was quieter. Thick stone walls surrounded us, and one might almost forget that a siege was being waged outside. Only 3 ladies-in-waiting attended the Queen. They would have been legion in the palace, but Isandra was enough Roland's daughter that she would not permit her household staff to follow her to war. Those who had come had done so of their own choice. The Isandine chirurgeon, whose name was Lelalia Valet, checked my bandages once, then tended to the gash on Jocelyn's arm and departed, bowing. After a change of clothes, a gown borrowed from one of Isandra's ladies-in-waiting, I felt a little more myself. Isandra had bread and cheese and wine brought in for us. I was not hungry, but ate a bit, as it does not do to disdain a queen's hospitality, and indeed it settled my frayed nerves, and a glass of wine helped to dull the throbbing pain to a more bearable level.
"We don't have much time," Isandra announced, sitting upright in a chair and looking at Jocelyn and me with a direct gaze. "Whatever happens this day, I want you both to know that I issued a pardon before we left the city, proclaiming your innocence in the death of Anarfiel de Launay, and all who are here know as much."
Tears stung my eyes. "Thank you, my lady," I murmured, overwhelmed with gratitude that she should remember such a thing in the midst of war. Jocelyn bowed, echoing my thanks with heartfelt fervour. Isandra waved them away.
"I'm sorry I didn't dare it earlier," she said bluntly, "but if word reached D'Eglamour or Melisande Charizai, it would have alerted them. And even to the end, we were not entirely sure who could be trusted."
"You didn't find Melisande," I said, hoping to hear otherwise. Isandra shook her head grimly. "The Castellan Brotherhood kept eyes and ears open as they bore messages, but we didn't dare search openly, for the same reason I couldn't pardon you publicly. If she had means of contacting Voldemar Selig, she might have told him we were prepared, and he would have changed his plans. Our chances were slim enough as they stood," she added, nodding soberly at the fortress walls.
"Of course," I said politely, though I wished it were not so.
Isandra stood and paced, shooting restless glances at the doorway. Her own Castellan guards stood back, watching attentively, and occasionally stealing furtive looks at Jocelyn, who ignored them. At last she halted, and asked in a tentative voice, quite unlike her usual cool tone,
"Is it true, then, that Drustin Mab Nectner rules as Kruark in Alba? Did he send any word for me?"
So that was it. I had forgotten, in all that had happened,
but a young woman's heart was at stake in the matter. I nearly smiled then. To my surprise, Jocelyn did, ducking his head to hide it, eyes crinkling at the corners.
"Your Majesty, I saw him crowned before we left Alba's shore," I said firmly, and added honestly, "if he sent no word, it is because he did not know what I intended. And I did not tell him because I did not expect to survive this last journey, and his honour is too great to have allowed me to make it. I have seen it again and again, that he would put himself at risk in his people's stead. But this I can tell you. Alone among our allies, Drustin Mab Nectina rides towards Twalamore with his head held high and a joyful heart, because he rides toward you. The dream that you shared together, of two mighty nations ruled side by side, lives on in him. If his people had not risen up to follow him, he would have set out to retake his throne alone, and had he fallen in the attempt, his last thought would have been of you." Isandra kept her restraint, but colour glowed in her pale cheeks. "Thank you," she murmured.
"Your Majesty," Jocelyn said soberly, "one of the great honours of my life is Drustin Mab Nectina calling me brother. He is a courageous and good leader, and I think in his quiet, Kruinya way, he is very madly in love with you." Her blush deepened.
"I didn't think Carsleans were supposed to notice such things," Isandra said tartly, masking her reaction. Her own Carsleen guards held their expressions impassive.
"No," Jocelyn said, wryly glancing at me, "they're not."
"Your Majesty!"
A soldier in a mail shirt, his helmet under his arm, appeared at the door.
"The sky is beginning to lighten. My Lord de Somerville would have conference with you."
Isandra left then, taking her guards and attendants with her, leaving Jocelyn and me alone.
It was hard to speak of it after what had happened.
"How did you know?" I asked softly.
He shook his head. "I don't know. I awoke and knew something was amiss. When I saw you had gone, I just knew. And I knew what Selig would do if he caught you."
"I thought you'd betrayed us all for your vow, before the end. I had to say it. I'm sorry."
"I don't blame you." He gave me his wry look.
"You know it is something every Carsleen learns, the Terminus. But no one's ever used it in living memory."
He studied his hands. "I nearly killed us both."
"Jocelyn," I touched his face, "I know. And until the day I die, I will be grateful for it."
There was more, so much more I wanted to say to him, but I could not find the words, and there was no time for it. Jocelyn caught my hand and held it hard.
"It would have saved Hyacinth the trouble of drowning me, if I'd let Selig have you," he said with a lightness neither of us felt. We could hear shouting outside the door and the sound of running feet. "Can you walk? We might find out what's happening."
"I would have walked here if you'd have let me," I said, struggling to stand. "You should go find your father."
Jocelyn cocked his head, listening, then shook it. "It's too late. I'd only be in the way, and take his mind off the battle." He gave a rueful smile. "At least he knew I was no murderer before the end."
It was small consolation, but it would have to do. I squeezed his hand once more, in lieu of things unsaid. "Come on."
Chapter 89.
We made our way through the fortress, sidling along the walls to avoid the lines of rushing soldiers. The ascent up the southeast tower was the worst, climbing the narrow spiral of stairs. Jocelyn did his best to shield me, but the passage was too small. Once or twice I nearly cried out as my back brushed against a rough outcropping of stone. Still we made our way upward and gained the battlements of the eastern wall, guessing aright that the command watch would be stationed there. In the leaden light of pre-dawn, it was like a scene straight out of hell. I had been amid the Scaldi camp, but I'd not understood, until then, what life had been like for those besieged in the fortress.
An ocean of Scaldi surged on the plain below, breaking like waves at the edge of the moat, spears and arrows arching upward toward the parapet. Pots of Faux de Hellas smoked and stank on the battlement, the east-pointing trebuchet cranked and waiting. Archers crouched at the arrow slits with crossbows, their seconds standing by with a replacement strung and ready. A longbow can fire 6 arrows to the single bolt of a crossbow on the field, but there is no weapon better in defending stone. Amid this chaos, cool and composed behind one of the high merlons of the crenellated wall, stood Isandre de la Courcelle, Queen of Terre d'Ange, in discussion with Percy de Somerville, Gaspard Trevelyan, and Barquier Lambert. Spotting Jocelyn and me in the tower, de Somerville sent a detachment of soldiers to escort us, shields braced outward against Scaldi weapons.
"Good," de Somerville said calmly. "I'm glad you're here. Selig's got his temper under control. He's still focused on the assault, but he just sent out scouting parties in 6 directions, and I think he's increased the guard on the perimeter. What's Guilin's angle of approach?"
"Due east," I said, pointing toward the foothills. De Somerville put his eye to the arrow slit and squinted through it.
"How long until they arrive, if they begin to move at first light?"
2 hours, I guessed.
Jocelyn shook his head. "They'll be moving in a hurry, and Selig's sentries will give warning long before they get there. I wouldn't worry about scouting parties. They're no match for the Cruinia. But once they're on flat ground, they'll be seen. For Scaldi won't wait. They'll take the battle to them. 1 hour, no more, I think."
"If Selig divides his forces, we're in trouble." Barquier Lambert tucked the trailing end of his burnous more securely beneath his helm. "He could leave 10,000 men here to keep us penned in, and still outnumber the Albans 2-1.
I rose on tiptoes to peer through the arrow slit. Below, out of arrow range, Voldemar Selig rode a tall horse, a mighty figure, ranging back and forth along the line, shouting exhortations at the Scaldi. "They'll follow Selig," I said, drawing back. "If he turns, they'll all go, and Isidore de Glamour is aiming for him." I could see how little they liked it still, mistrusting de Glamour's loyalty. I didn't blame them.
"So be it," Percy de Somerville said at length. "Cousin," he nodded at Gaspard Trevelyan, "with your folk in Azal, we can spare you from the field the most, and you're the only one I trust to make the choice. With the army mustered below, we need a signal we can see from the gatehouse. Use the trebuchet and Fur de Hellas. If Selig breaks east and his army follows, fire east, and we fall on their rear. If he divides his forces, fire west, and we'll sweep to the left and engage their weak side." "It will be done," Gaspard Trevelyan murmured. "Eloire be with us all."
They took their farewells then, the men clasping each other's hands. Percy de Somerville bowed to Isandre.
"Your Majesty," he said soberly, "I served under your grandfather for many years. But if I die today, I die proud to have served under you."
She stood very tall and straight on the grey walls of the battlements. "And I to have been served by you, Comte de Somerville. Eloise's blessing upon you." To my surprise, Barquier Lambert grinned and kissed his niece on the brow.
"Take care of yourself, Isandre. You make a damned good queen. We'll do our best to see you stay one."
He nodded at Jocelyn and me.
"Keep these 2 with you, will you? They seem to be damnably hard to kill."
I did not always like the Duc Lambert, but I could not help loving him then. When they were gone, Isandre shivered and wrapped her deep blue cloak with the Courcelle swan embroidered in silver at the collar tight around her.
"I must speak to Faron de Marchais, who commands the trebuchet crew on the western wall," Gaspard Trevelyan said apologetically. "Will you not go below to safety, Your Majesty?"
"No," Isandre shook her fair head. "I will stay here, my lord. Terre d'Ange stands or falls with us this day, and so do I. We'll stay, I said to Gaspar. It made no earthly difference, save for Lambert's flippant comment, but it was enough. He nodded and set off quickly, a company of shields with him. We stood there and watched the skies lighten as dawn broke full in the east, and the sun slowly began to clear the horizon. Jocelyn kept a watchful eye to the arrow slit, looking for our army. A handful of Isandra's House Courcelle guard, as well as her ever-present Castellines, surrounded us. Still, I think there was no one else to whom she dared speak her mind. "I have your book still, Your Majesty," I said presently, casting about for something to say. "Your father's diary. It is with my things in our camp. I kept it with me all this time."
"Did you read it?" She smiled sadly. "It was very beautiful, I thought."
"It was. He loved wisely, too. Delaunay lived for the memory of that love." I didn't mention Alcuin, though I was glad now that Delaunay had known a second happiness.
"I know."
Isandra glanced down into the courtyard far below, and to the four of us, filled with a tight mass of men. "I'm glad he made his peace with my uncle before he died. My mother caused a great deal of pain, I think."
"Yes."
I couldn't gainsay her. "People do for love or for power."
"Or honour."
She looked sympathetically at me. "I'm sorry you were drawn into this, Fedra. Please know that whatever